Is that good?
Yes.
Yeah, excellent. Good morning.
Good morning.
Of all the places studying martial arts have taken me over the years, I never once thought it would bring me to a place of worship. This is really nifty, and I thank you all so much for inviting me here to speak today. When I mention to people that I'm a professional martial artist, what I most often get in response is a laugh, followed by some iteration of, well, I better not mess with you. That reaction always struck me as kind of off, and for the longest time, it sort of bothered me. However, over the years, I've come to realize that what they were really saying to me is, why? Why do you do this thing that I know nothing about and am maybe a little intimidated by? It's a fair question, especially in the context of how our society views martial arts and martial artists. After all, Steven Seagal is a real person. And we as humanity must ultimately fess up to that fact. It may take some time. Whenever most of us think about martial arts and the art's place in pop culture, it's those pop culture references that first occur to people. Images of Bruce Lee kicking and screaming, filmed Hollywood fight scenes, and bloody overhyped MMA matches are often first to come to mind. I'm not Bruce. I've only been in a handful of really terrible movies, and with one eye, I'm just not much of the cage anymore. So, especially given in that context, it's a reasonable question to ask, why do I do this? My answer is complex and deeply personal, as I imagine it is for anyone engaged in a lifelong study. My reasons for starting martial arts, however, were pretty damn simple. I grew up Jewish and moderately... I'm moderately ethnic looking in Lake Oswego. Now, I never realized either of those things were a problem until my elementary school classmates and teachers made it a point. It was that classic American story that we were all so lucky to repeating again in 2018. My mom grew tired of the bullying and ultimately overcame her passive nature and signed me up for martial arts lessons. Training very quickly gave me the skills I needed to defend myself and made life immeasurably better. Eventually, my parents got me into a safer school, and in my new environment, the need for martial training vanished. Absent the need, my want to practice soon followed, and 5 years passed. Eventually, high school hit, and again I was struggling, this time with dyslexia. I was enrolled in a high-pressure prep school and was in danger of getting expelled because I was falling so far behind. Searching for a way to both vent excess energy and improve my concentration, I decided to get back into training. To date, it has been one of the best decisions I've ever made. Through training, I found a focus and drive that transcended the dojo to permeate every aspect of my life. I was hooked. In 2001, I left Oregon to start my studies at Pitzer College in Claremont, California. Upon arriving, I hunted down every martial arts class in the 5 campuses and enrolled in all of them. By the end of my first year, 2 programs stood above the rest. The first was the Chinese martial art Baguazhang that Pastor Craig and I do together. Through Bagua, I found meditation and movement, and for the first time in memory, a glimpse of what calm might be. The second was the Afro-Brazilian style capoeira. Capoeira gave me a social group, and with it, some of the greatest friends I've ever had. To date, these styles remain as 2 of the great loves of my life. In the 17 years that followed, I have traveled the world and trained extensively in LA, Hawaii, Brazil, and Beijing, China. In each new city, I was welcomed by the martial arts community, my arrival preceded by the reputation of my instructors and their contributions to the arts. Of my early travels, the most influential by far was my first solo trip to Brazil in 2006. I had already visited the country once before, well, in undergrad. My capoeira teacher, Mestre Batata, had taken a small group of us on a tour of Rio de Janeiro, Recife, and Vitoria. It was a great experience, full of misadventures, as I stumbled around the country for 3 weeks under the direct supervision of my mentor. This trip, however, was much different, as solo travel always is. At the time, I was 24 years old and in desperate need of a break from graduate school. Mestre Batata had arranged for me to stay with his younger brother, Cibola, who was a high-ranking capoeira teacher nearing the rank of master himself. I landed in Vitoria Espirito Santo after a day of travel and was met by Cibola in the airport. After taking a night to acclimate, I began shadowing Cibola on his daily teaching routine. Long ago, his elder brother Batata had set up a series of capoeira programs in underserved communities for street kids. In his first years in teaching Vitória, Batata took on 25 students who he described as the worst of the worst, kids seen as lost causes by the community. Batata poured himself into his work, heart and soul. Over the years, he became like a father to these children, nurturing, teaching, and in some cases, burying them. At the time of my visit, his students had grown to adulthood. And when Batata moved to Santa Monica in 2001, these once troubled kids took over the task of carrying on and expanding his work with kids' programs of their own. It was a beautiful example of how paying it forward can actually succeed in changing a community. Batata's brother Cibola's classes were predominantly taught in government-run schools called projetos, or the projects. In these schools, Cibola and I worked in tandem as professores de physical, or PE teachers. Our classes focused predominantly on capoeira training and capoeira traditions. A typical workday with Cibola started at 4 in the morning. We would wake, drink a gallon of coffee, eat some dainty cakes, and rush to the bus stop by 5:30. What followed was an hour and a half bus ride through the favelas of Vitória. For long sections of the bus ride, Cibola would insist that I not speak. According to him, my accent was a dead ringer for a foreigner, and being spotted as such was dangerous. Though I have some suspicion he just wanted some quiet. Either way. After an hour of driving, the streets would begin to open, and we would come upon a brightly colored building. This was the school, and around it was an 8-foot-tall wrought iron gate, and in front, a smiling armed security guard. The juxtaposition of the school compared with the surrounding neighborhood never ceased to remind me of exactly where I was. Depending on the day, we visited one of two schools, either Projeto Vida or Projeto ASCA. The students arrived at 7:30, and we began teaching at 8, finishing at 3:30 p.m. And that's pretty much what we did, 6 days a week. We would teach 8 one-hour classes with a 30-minute lunch break in the middle. It was a grueling and immersive experience. Even at 24 years old, I'm embarrassed to report that there were several days when my energy faded and no amount of coffee could revive me. To my amazement, Cibola seemed immune to such human frailty, and while I took naps on cardboard boxes, making deals with large roving beetles to leave me alone, he would always push on with the program. There are so many aspects of working in the projetos that touched me. The teachers were competent, dedicated, and kind, and the Montessori-esque tactics were just fantastic and inspiring to watch. But most of all, it was the kids that had the greatest impact. Endlessly patient with the blundering American, they never failed to make me feel welcome. In particular, there was a child named Walt Disney, who would routinely steal my Lonely Planet translation guide and force me to speak to him in Portuguese. He was the kid I bonded with most, and is also chiefly responsible for my flimsy grasp of the language. Cibola's teaching style was also wonderfully submersive, his lessons always stretching beyond the simple act of giving the kids a physical outlet. To accomplish this, he taught in two parts. The first is what you would generally anticipate from a martial arts class. The students were expected to behave in an orderly and disciplined way. People waited their turns in line, raised their hands for questions, and generally maintained an atmosphere of respect towards their peers and instructors. That alone was great, but what really struck me was the humanitarian nature of his subtext. No partner drill started without a handshake, and no one was ever left out, regardless of race, gender, or handicap. Through the classes, each student had a chance to demonstrate their value and find their place in the group, either as an athlete, dancer, singer, or group leader. With these roles, the group began to transcend a martial arts class and started to form a community. The community Cibola created in the projetos directly mirrored the one his brother Batata had built in the greater Vitória area. I remember walking through the streets near Cibola's home in the favelas of Vitória, the murder capital of Brazil, wearing my white capoeira shirt with the school crest, a large beetle covered by instruments. I distinctly recall the feeling that the thin cotton shirt provided better protection than any bulletproof vest ever could. Over time, I began to realize that in this neighborhood, the capoeira community was more than just a tribe. It was functionally a gang. At first, this revelation shook me. We're taught in America that gangs are bad. They're violent, toxic, and perpetuate crime. But here it was different. The Capuana community, created by Mestre Batata, had given this neighborhood something solid to band around. It was still a gang, to be sure. There were gang colors, secret handshakes, back-alley deals made with both drug dealers and the corrupt police. But all of this served one purpose, to protect the people in the community. You must understand that the favelas of Brazil are a place where escape from poverty is virtually impossible. As Cibola once said, "I believe that in America, if you do everything right and are a little lucky, you can rise above where you were born." Here it's not so. If you are born here, you will die here. The only question is how and when. It was a somber sentiment, but one reiterated by many of his colleagues. In a land absent honest police and government assistance, ravaged by unfettered late-stage capitalism, the Capuana Mafia, the Capuana Mafia kept the streets safe as they could, and there was a tragic beauty to it all. Teaching Capuana in Brazil taught me more than anything that we are responsible for creating the world in which we wish to live. Wherever we find ourselves, we must build a community, vibrant and caring, because at the end of the day, we are the ones with skin in this game. In a blink of an eye, my time in Vitória was over. Boarding my flight, I remember promising Cibola's family that I'd return to Brazil as soon as I could. But life does what it does, and I'm sad to report that in the 13 years since, I have yet to return. I still hope to bring my family there someday and show them the adoptive community that helped me to find my place in my own. Returning to LA, I found it surprisingly difficult to get back in my old rhythm. I remember vividly walking through the Atlanta, Georgia airport on the trip home and spotting a vending machine full of iPods. With all the exhaustion of travel, that was the first moment where culture shock really set in. Immediately, I had a flashback to Cibola's wife, Rosalie, warning me to never take my iPod out in public, as it was worth roughly 6 months' rent, and someone would gleefully remove it from my still-dead corpse if I were so foolish. Pausing by the vending machine, my eyes filled with tears as it sank in just how far I was from Brazil. All I wanted was to return to the work with Cibola. I missed the grueling simplicity of our schedule, all the new friends I made, and most of all, the kids. Fortunately, it wasn't long before I had the opportunity to get back to the job I love. After my return, Mestre Batata started looking to expand his 501c3 Capoeira outreach program called Jinga Arts. In 2007, the program had just begun to find its legs. And Batata approached me to ask if I would be interested in helping. I jumped at the opportunity, and before I knew it, the program had grown to over 500 students, 80 of which were directly under me. It was a daunting and challenging task. I had never before been responsible for my own program and found the audience drastically different than both the school clubs and Brazilian schools I was accustomed to. There are many differences between teaching capoeira in Brazil, a country that recognizes the art as a point of cultural pride, and teaching in the US, where it's simply a shiny novelty. However, many of the challenges and goals are the same. As Jamie Lee Curtis said of our program at one of our fundraisers, kids have to get their creative yayas out. It's important. And Jinga Arts provided them with that opportunity. And along the way, we strive to achieve our deeper goals of teaching the students to interact with each other respectfully and build a community that can withstand the pervasive and destructive pressures of living in South LA. Through Jinga Arts, I witnessed an amazing series of transformations in my students. Groups that were once divided on lines based on gender, race, and socioeconomics began to blur. Kids saw past those delineations and began to interact with each other in new ways. Over the years, confidence grew, behavioral problems diminished, and it was amazing to me how well the LA programs mimicked the Projeto classes I taught with Cibola. From the moment Batata brought me on until I left LA in 2010, I was dedicated to Jinga Arts. Today, the program has swelled, providing free capoeira lessons to thousands of underserved students in communities around South LA. There are scores of teachers carrying on the work that Batata and I started. 11 years later, I've had the pleasure of running into several of my old students, many of whom have now graduated high school and some even made it to college. Of course, not everyone we worked with had a happy ending, but life is tough, and life in South Central LA is tougher than most. I'm reminded of a story told by religious naturalist Lauren Aisley, the starfish thrower. It's a tale of an old man walking on the beach after a storm, where tens of thousands of starfish are washed ashore. On his walk, he comes across a young boy frantically tossing starfish back into the sea before they die of exposure. Upon approaching the boy, the old man says, "There must be tens of thousands of starfish on this beach. I'm afraid you won't be able to make much of a difference." In response, the boy bent down, picked up yet another starfish, and threw it as far as he could in the ocean. Then he turned, smiled, and said, "It made a difference to that one." At the end of the day, that's similar to how I view my role in the martial arts. In all probability, neither you nor I will be able to change the lives of tens of thousands of people. What we can do is give care for our communities one person at a time. I hope that helps answer the question I put forth first as to why. Thank you so much. Should I take questions? Or?
Sure.
If anyone has any questions about Capoeira or the work we do in Portland, be happy to take some.
Where in South LA were you working?
There were a half dozen sites back then, and so my schedule was 7 classes a week just at different small schools throughout the area.
I taught at Figueroa Street School.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Nice. Yes?
Where do you work here?
I have a studio at 44th and Northeast Gleason, so right across the highway.
And how many classes and that kind of thing do you have?
It's a pretty full schedule at the studio now. I teach over 20 classes a week in terms of group and both group and private lessons. I teach a mix of Beijing Kung Fu and Capoeira. Before my wife became too very pregnant, she ran all the kids' programs. But since I've started to take over again and handle those while she finishes up this process. Yes?
What age group do you focus on?
So the Kung Fu classes are kids through adults. The Capoeira classes start around age 6, though if the child is 5 and has the parent, you know, there to watch over, we're more than happy to take them in when they're a little bit younger. And then those classes go from 6 through adulthood. Yes? I used to teach a program in LA where I teach fall prevention to seniors through Tai Chi. And I still offer a Tai Chi class at my studio where I have had some elderly students come through and work on that sort of thing. Yeah. Yes?
Who finances your program?
We are, it's a private business. So in LA, it was all a 501c3, and we did a lot of work for grants and fundraisers. Here, once the family is a little older, we're going to try to get back into that sort of work and build a partner program with Jinga Arts down there. That's how I make some of my kids a little bit bigger.
So is your program paid for by money from students?
It is, yes. Yeah.
What about poor students?
No one's ever turned away for lack of funds. We offer many scholarships. We have students who work in trade. We have students who've fallen on hard times. They're all still at the school. Yeah. Yes?
I'm curious. It sounds like you're teaching more than one style, and I know that they have their different philosophies, and so I'm curious about whether you see like a single through line of philosophy or spirituality connected to it.
That's a great question. I have kind of two parts to that. So when I began, I wasn't looking at that angle very closely. It was more whichever of my two masters, the Kung Fu master, the Capoeira master, was in a better mood, that's where I tend to hang out. And as they're both fairly volatile individuals, it was, you know, kind of 50-50 shot of where was the best place to be that week. Though later on in my career, I did do a study interviewing about a dozen teachers of Kung Fu and a dozen teachers of Capoeira to get their view on the base energetic qualities of their styles. In Kung Fu, it's Qi theory, which permeates a lot of Chinese medical theory, sciences, and martial arts. And in Capoeira, it's Ashe. They're essentially the same thing, just, you know, just energy. In the Kung Fu systems, it's mostly internally created through Qigong practices, breathing, meditative movement, that sort of thing. In Capoeira, it's a bit different. So a Capoeira interaction always takes place in a community. You really can't have just two people doing Capoeira properly. And this falls back to the history of Capoeira, which was it developed as a response to slavery in Brazil. And so in the senzalas and the places where the slaves lived, they, at the end of their workday, would make big circles and play music and sing. And the circles were an opaque barrier, shoulder to shoulder, of people standing in that line. In the middle, two people would be practicing martial arts. If the slaveholder came by, the rhythm would change to samba, and the whole thing would turn into a dance party. And so there's this big history in capoeira of the community being directly supportive of the practice and the art. So energia, the yashe, is a thing that occurs from everyone singing and putting their energy towards the two people in the center. And so whereas in Kung Fu the energy is internally derived, in capoeira it's externally derived and accepted from those around you in your community. So you really can't ever separate capoeira from the people who practice with you. It becomes like a family in every group. Does that answer your question? Cool. Yes.
Essentially oppression. The peasants could not own a weapon, and the samurai could kill anyone they wanted to.
There have been martial arts uprisings all over the world, and that is part of the case in Japan. That story has actually been a little bit overblown. In that, you know, scythes weren't actually gardening tools and nunchucks weren't actually for reaping grain. That's kind of been embellished over the years. But there's absolutely a kernel of truth in that. And in Brazil, I think, is the purest example of a community coming up from really no martial culture. I mean, they had the dance that came from Angola. There were some indigenous martial arts in the Angola area, but nothing as formalized or as aggressive as you had through capoeira. You got a bit of that in China as well through the Opium Wars and the Boxer Rebellion, where, of course, people were once again under the similar colonial oppression, and the martial artists rose up and dealt a pretty hefty blow, which is why in China, even today, the government's a little wary of actual martial art training, which is where, you know, Wushu and American Taiji tends to come from. So yeah, there are instances all over of where people who are just, you know, being taken advantage of by another group find and create the sort of martial identity to form backlash. Anything else? Awesome. Well, thank you so much again. It was really fun being here with all of you.
I invite you now into the spirit of meditation, prayer, or quiet reflection.